non-burning questions. Like the horn of an Indian rhinoceros.
Yes. The African rhino has two horns. Funny sort of thing.
Yeah, that's interesting.
You pointed out the rhinoceros is a gregarious animal.
Is it? Morris was just saying that Dr. Norman, who's a president, Pali scholar, was saying that translating that verse about rhinoceros, that it probably meant the horn of the rhinoceros, because the Indian rhinoceros has one horn. And it doesn't have two, and it's the only mammal that has one horn. Yeah, it's a special. It means, you know, it's implying the sense of not being caught in the flow of just the mundane life, and the special quality of one pointedness. Ekakata. So, do you have any questions? Yes? Well, with the importance, the Buddha was teaching, say, on one level, for how to live in a society, that's through the sila, like the moral, taking on the moral responsibility for what we do, and like being generous and moral and kind were the qualities for living in the world. Relating to others in the right way, and being generous, and refraining from doing things that harm ourselves and others, and so that would apply to, you know, like right livelihood, right action, right speech is necessary for the holy life, for religious development, and then the palana is the meditation or cultivation of the mind, and that also can be done in lay life. It's not a prerogative of monastics, but in lay life it tends to especially now in a modern society that's very materialistic. All the messages you get are usually non-spiritual ones. You know, all the kind of things that you're confronted with are usually, you know, like you can see, capitalism tends to increase selfishness. We think about ourselves all the time, and what we look like, and what we have, and all that, and just the advertising here in Britain is just, you know, you can't help but always be thinking about yourself, and these things are very, you know, have powerful effect on the mind. But also, at the same time, the amount of suffering that exists in Britain or in Western Europe or in affluent societies is can't be blamed on the fact of, you know, the external conditions so much as it's the way we think in ways that make us suffer all the time, like being selfish. When we're obsessed with ourselves, then we suffer. To have to think about yourself very much is real suffering. And so when, you know, when you can liberate your mind from thinking about yourself, then you don't suffer. Or it diminishes. You don't create suffering. And so the pavana, the cultivation, is to develop the right attitude. So that's something that we encourage. Like here in Britain now, say Buddhism is now, say, it has a lot, there's a lot of Buddhist centers and a lot of teaching. There's a lot more available for people here. And because people are interested, there is a real interest now in meditation, because people need to realize that their lives are meaningless, and even when they have their BMW and everything, that they're still, you know, basically quite unhappy, and that unhappiness is something you can't just get away from by getting something new, but through mental development, because it's all from the way we start thinking. And this is something that I've seen just in, you know, I've experimented with. In, for example, the average person sees that my suffering is due to somebody else or something, you know, the fact that somebody else is doing something to me that's not nice, or that life hasn't been fair, or you know, external things have not given me everything that I think I should have to make me happy. And then a more mature way of looking is we begin to see that we create on our unhappiness. And it isn't, even if somebody is causing us, telling lies about us or slandering us or doing horrible things to us, it's the real suffering we create is our hatred, aversion, resentment. What they're doing is not really the suffering. It's our reaction that is the suffering. Now this is when you begin to really understand that, then you're not so concerned about what people do or say about you, because you know how to respond, or how not to create resentment and anger and all that over the experiences of life, because life is, you know, inevitably. So much of our human experience is going to be unpleasant. It's just a natural thing. It's not because anything wrong with you or anything wrong with life. It's just the way it is. That this realm we live in is so fraught. It's so sensitive. So, and we're in such a vulnerable state that we're always in, you know. We are in a state where we do suffer enormously because of the continuous irritation that comes through sensitivity, but we don't know how to interpret. We take it personally, then we get it all wrong. And then learning to interpret it through wisdom, through Dhamma, rather than through, say, social conditioning or personality views. So in business or any profession, it's learning how to relate to, say, professional conditions, to family, to we might not be able to help, you know, like we do have the families we have, and we have, you know, we can't always have what we want or the best of what we would like. But the way it is, that's something we can, if just by developing a proper attitude towards it, we don't create suffering around it. And talking to people like with disabilities and that, they you know, if they develop the right attitude towards a disability, they don't suffer. I mean, they're still disabled, but they aren't creating misery about the fact that they are. Whereas the disabled people then that feel sorry for themselves and blame everybody and resent, and then they're not only suffering from a disability but from they're compounding the misery through resentment and aversion. So that's why you think, well, we can't always help what happened. You know, in a car accident, you get paralyzed, you get old, and you, various, anything could happen to us, and we recognize that these, you know, this possibility. But when we realize that no matter what happens to us, if we see it in the right way, then we are strengthened through it. Sometimes we're really strengthened through adversity, through having to go through really difficult, painful, unwanted experiences. When we look at it in the right way, we come out with incredible confidence and strength. It's a real test. And we're really quite resilient and tough creatures, human beings. When we have to be, we get soft and wimpy in modern middle class existence. But even that's an illusion. When it really comes to the crunch, we can really be tough. We can survive anything. And the more we realize that we can survive not through survival of the fittest, but through compassion, through understanding. Not through just, you know, bullying people or using power to survive at the expense of others, but through understanding Dhamma. Well, they have, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and that. Well, we usually have various funeral chants and reflections, and the idea is to, when somebody dies, to do good deeds. To do things in their like our generous acts, and that will help them. And so what we're doing is, I mean, but there's no, we haven't developed in Theravada such a kind of teaching as the Tibetan Book of the Dead. But the attitude is one of doing good works. And offering the blessings of that in memory of the departed, because in many ways that is a benefit to everyone, and to you, to the one that died, to all creatures, because like say goodness, when we do things out of, you know, with the right way for good reasons, then we're that's say like a universal offering. It's not just affecting just one being. But there's a lot of theories about the what they call the vijnana when somebody dies, and they usually chant, and then on the 50th day or 49th day, they have special almsgiving ceremonies in Theravada. And for the Chinese Master Hua, they had a 49th day, just like in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the Bardo type, 49 days on the... They didn't actually, it wasn't the Tibetan Book of the Dead, but they did have a memorial ceremony on the 49th day after his death. And then we chant, they had monks from all traditions, all Buddhist traditions, there in a temple in Long Beach, and we did our own kind of funeral chant. So the Vietnamese had a certain style, and the Theravadins, we did ours, and Chinese. He wasn't cremated yet. Then after that, they cremated the body the following week. But they had the body lying in state where we could all meditate on it. They had people continue all, 24 hours a day for 49 days chanting and meditating in this special chapel in the city of 10,000 Buddhas. People were in that all the time. I went at one time at 3 in the morning and the room was filled with people. The aim, I think, in Taoism and in all forms of Buddhism is to kind of open to nature itself. His Dhamma itself can be translated as nature, but it's everything: body, the conditions of mind, what we see or hear, all, everything is Dhamma. And what happens is that when we contemplate the beauties of nature, natural things, say that haven't been tampered with human defilements, usually when we contemplate them, they bring us peace of mind. So, I mean, listening to the sound of a waterfall, or looking at the sky, or looking at the trees, when we just concentrate on these natural things, they tend to lead us into calm, tranquil state. It's like your own breath. When you contemplate your own breath, you'll feel calm by your just being with the natural rhythm of breathing of your own body. And then you'll find that the man-made things tend to excite you. Usually, a city is filled with things made by humans to excite or attract or to boast or to, say, look at me, or to arouse envy, or to proclaim one's ego, or whatever. So That's why sometimes when it seems, you know, when your mind has been soothed and tranquilized with natural things, how jarring, say, man-made things can be. Because they tend to come at from kind of demanding, egotistical side, where nature is what it is. Even the dark clouds or the soil, the dirt under your feet, these kind of things can calm your mind. I've seen this, just say being in retreat for maybe a month. And one time at Chitterst, being in retreat for quite a long time, and then having to go to London, and you could feel, after just your whole, your senses, your mind had been in the forest for so many weeks, and you really hadn't been talking to people, and you'd mainly been meditating all that time, and your whole system had become calm and used to the peacefulness of nature. And then going in a car up the A3 and get close to London, and get into London, all the exciting things, you know, the traffic, the way people dress, the advertisements, the buildings, the whole thing, you know, stimulating the mind. And you could really see how harsh it was. It's like, you know, because you were in a very sensitive state. And then when you live in London for a while, you get used to all that. You get used to all that. So you don't see it in that, because you're not, you couldn't possibly live in London in that highly sensitive state without, you know, not feeling, more continuously overwhelmed by the slightest thing. But then, so the Buddha was emphasizing this mindfulness rather than just, say, hermetic practice as a way to liberation. Because, say, a hermit might go off into the mountains and live in just with nature and refuse to have anything to do with London or New York or any place like that. But the Buddha, you see, kind of advised the monks at first to go off into the forests, like the idea of go, because the forests are helpful in that way of calming your mind and not stimulating your mind. And then but then the idea wasn't, we didn't make it a rule that you could only live in the forest, that you had to be related to the villages, the townspeople, and so forth, so we're not forbidden to go into the towns, but we're also, you know, to develop awareness around it so that even the harsh impingement, strident impingement, we're not developing aversion towards. So that we're developing a wisdom faculty, so that even the most horrible things that might happen to us, we can relate to through non-aversion rather than through anger, aversion, resentment. And I find that very helpful, like in say, living in a community where you have so many different people, so many things happen, if you could have everyone, you know, all the monks and nuns just in this very wise, very mindful, very sensitive, very committed, very peaceful people. But in any community, you've got you've got good people, but then the personality clashes and the various emotions are triggered off for various reasons, I used to find aversion coming up. And then by contemplating that more and more, then I learn, becoming more and more skillful, not to create aversion around the things that happen, say, or the, and especially the unpleasant things that happen. So that's wisdom, developing wisdom, where the other is more like getting attached to refinement, where you become very dependent on things that tranquilize your mind. Where this way, you more or less can work with whatever's happening. You take if you're in an airport or you're in a queue or you're in traffic jam in Bangkok or whatever. I mean, you know how to relate to it, not through wishing you were somewhere else, but through being able to have the right attitude towards the conditions you're experiencing. Yes, George? Well, I think the idea of seeing anything in terms of a permanent quality is a delusion, because we tend, like, the when we attach to the conditioning of the mind, then we can easily just kind of see things in very fixed ways and see something as something ugly is permanently ugly, or something beautiful as, kind of absolutizing these things. So we become disillusioned when say the beauty is gone and we feel betrayed, or oftentimes if we see something as ugly, then if it becomes beautiful, we can't even see the beauty because we've already fixed it in our mind as ugly. And it's like racial prejudices or ethnic biases or all these things, you tend to fix your perceptions, and in a way that you whether somebody is beautiful and or not, if they just don't fit your conditioned view of beauty, then you can't see it. You see everything according to a very rigid and narrow conditioning, and that that's very common. Like witch hunting and these kind of fundamentalist groups that see everything from very rigid views, and everything that doesn't fit into that view is considered the devil or the alien or bad. And so they've got a very narrow way of looking at life. And so even the beauty and the goodness of somebody else could not be seen because they've already perceived it as ugly. So like last year when Venerable Sobhano went to Mount Athos in Greece, and he said, they're so convinced that any other religion but Orthodox Christianity is wrong, that all they could see him as was a devil, the monk there. They said he was a Buddhist. They could only see him as a devil. They couldn't see that he was good. He didn't look like Christian, but then if he said he was, somebody told me that if he was Roman Catholic, he would have even had a worse time. They got strong views against Roman Catholics. And this is like getting a very fixed perception. I've been called like satanic and that. I remember one time in Hampstead when somebody accused Ajahn Chah of being a Satan, devil. And we I remember telling Ajahn Chah, and he he thought it was funny. But he was just this man was couldn't see the goodness, because he couldn't conceive goodness as being a Buddhist, being anything connected with Buddhism. And so when we see the ugly, it's a visual sight, and then we dwell on it with aversion, then we tend to get caught up into habitual reactions to it. But if you even gaze on the ugly with an empty mind, then you're no longer creating a perception of ugliness, and then you begin to see things that in it that are quite beautiful. Like seeing, I remember going to an autopsy years ago in Bangkok, where they had a rotting corpse. Some person they'd found in one of the canals of about been dead for about a week in tropical country, and its corpse was in advanced state of decay, and just watching my mind relate to that, react to that, to the putrid stench, to the visual ugliness of it. It was ugly and it stank, and everything was repulsive on the level of just of first impression. And then as I didn't follow the first impulses and waited, and I began to concentrate on the actual decaying body, one could see a certain beauty in it, in the process of decay, because you weren't coming from just being repelled by it. And say the first reaction was repulsion and wanting to get out. Just the putrid smell so strong, so bad, that one just wanted to not look, and you felt your whole self wanting to run away. Then you kind of willed yourself into the place, meditated on the corpse, and then as this aversion ceased, then there was a calm, and then one could even see the beauty in the process of decay, which was quite peaceful, wasn't depressing at all. Or seeing the ugly and the beautiful. Sometimes they see because, say, if something's beautiful, then we tend to grasp it. With something ugly, we want to get rid of it, and when it's beautiful, we want to grasp it. So then we contemplate the ugliness and the beauty, which is a way of sustaining attention on the beautiful without following this kind of desire to hold it or to get it, and then one feels more a sense of peacefulness with beauty too, because it's not stimulating greed or lust. It's more you're seeing the impermanence, that beauty is a perception, and then it's a visual beauty, and then as you discriminate more, say, rather than just be dazzled by the first impression, then you can see the things that aren't beautiful in the beautiful. But then that's not to be averse to them, but it actually both take you to a level of calm and dispassion. So in, say for sexual desire, lust, where say when lust takes over the mind, one tends to see the object as desirable, and then the discriminative mind stops working. Once you're taken over by lust, then you don't tend to see, you can lose your sense of shame, of moral responsibility, of you just want to get what you desire, and you don't see it in any discriminating way. All you're obsessed with the idea of getting. And then for the super practices where you contemplate the 32 parts of the body is to develop more discriminative awareness of the body, which leads to dispassion, because then you're not just taken over by the initial, say, lustful contact. You have a way of contemplating it and to see the unbeautiful in the beautiful. I should think so. I should like to think so. I mean, these days it's hard to be optimistic about humanity. Very hard. And but I'd rather be optimistic than pessimistic. Because I mean, yeah, I don't expect that to ever see a time where everybody's keeping the five precepts, but I think, you know, like the Maharishi, Mahesh Yogi, you know, they say if so many people chant and do good things, that affects the whole consciousness of the human consciousness on the planet, and I kind of like that view. I think if the more that we take on, say, the moral responsibilities, keeping the five precepts and developing kindness and that, then as more and more of us do that, then that will also affect the minds of others, because we're interconnected, interdependent. Well, the precepts, I think, they're more guidelines for actions. It's like taking on responsibility rather than kind of commandments that you have to keep the precepts. So it is a very mature religion, Buddhism, because it's you have to ask for the precepts. You have to say, Ajahn Sumedho, I would like to take the five precepts. I have no right to go and say, I want to give you the five precepts and make you take them, or to try to frighten you into doing it. You'll be damned to hell if you don't take the five precepts, that kind of thing. And the precepts are not commandments. They're not like God saying, you cannot kill, you cannot steal, and that. It's like you saying, I make the vow to refrain from intentionally killing, and that means it's a sense of that you're taking on responsibility for how you live, and that then those are guidelines for how to live. And then like with the first precept, not to kill, say in Bosnia, if we could just get the Serbs and the Croats and the Muslims to take the first Buddhist precept, that'd be a great improvement. And then they could kill all the mosquitoes in Bosnia, and we wouldn't look down on them. But other human beings, they refrain from doing that. That'd be great. But in terms of Buddhist monks, like we take the vow not to kill any, intentionally kill other creatures of any sort. So, I mean, this is our, you know, for us to go around killing mosquitoes and that is wrong, because our vow is one of not killing anything. But what I'm pointing to is a way of trying to bring people out, not just to lay the highest standard on everyone and then kind of look down on them if they can't keep it. But Buddhism is a much more gentle, more reasonable way of dealing with things, so that you're trying to uplift people, encourage people to rise up, not just intimidate them or ask them to do something they can't possibly. They like to ask fishermen to keep the first precept in the strictest interpretation means that they lose their livelihood. So, like in Thailand, the fishermen are pretty rough people and they kill each other. They were oftentimes the pirates that were going killing the Vietnamese refugees in boats. So I know I have a friend, a Buddhist monk in Thailand who lives on the coast where the fishermen are, and he encourages them to not kill each other. So he gives them the first precept, Manandibhata. And he said that makes a great deal of difference. I mean, they wouldn't even bother coming to see him if he said they couldn't kill any more fish. You see, so it's making it appropriate to time and place and to the ability of the people that you're with. That's where wisdom, mindfulness is the way, where you're taking into account the culture, the people you're with, the time and place. You're not just trying to lay something on everyone, like that everyone should live up to the highest moral standard that you can possibly think of, because very few could ever do that. But we all appreciate opportunities to be better, to rise up to a higher level. To kill the killers, or? Right. Right, but when you contemplate, contemplate, say, the victims and the victimizers, and I've contemplated this, if I'd rather be killed, knowing what I know now, I'd rather be killed than kill somebody. Because I'm going to die someday anyway. Isn't so important whether it's now or 20 years from now. But to have to live 20 more years knowing that I've killed somebody just out of anger and heedlessness, even if nobody should ever find out, if I should get away with it, nobody ever punished me, I would know no matter what. And that's what, you know, it's not a matter of punishing them, because they'll punish themselves. You never get away from that. Once you've committed murder, it's a punishment in itself. And so the idea of compassion then is for both the victim and the victimizer, and not to try to, you know, it's a natural feeling to take sides, you know, to want to get even and kill the murderer of children, and I can certainly feel things like that. It's not that I don't feel, have emotions like that, but I don't trust them. I wouldn't respect that in myself if I acted on that, because I feel that the victimizers are the real sufferers in this life. Yeah, but they live in a hell realm all the time, really. I mean, they create. I mean, they're ridden with fear, and because. Yeah, the real test is when it does happen to you. It's easy to talk about it. When it happens to somebody else. But I hope it doesn't happen to me. But if it does, you come and tell me, you know, if I start saying, I want to get even with that bloke, you say, remember Ajahn Sumedho? Well, in Buddhism, especially like in Tibetan Buddhism, they've got these wrathful deities and that. But this is wrath of compassion rather than of anger, of like aversion. Wrath is more, it's not coming from hating or being averse, but through compassion, wanting to help somebody. And sometimes wrath is you know, if there's not anger, you know, not that you dislike the person or want to hurt them, it's just that feeling of wanting to help them, and they need a strong warning. So you might, you know, like a child crossing a big street, and you yell at it and spank it to make your point. Say, don't you go out on that street. And that's wrathful compassion. Where, you know, because you, if you... He said, now, dear, don't go out in this street. You might get in my... Probably wouldn't hear it. Well, I don't know, because in modern science you don't know what they're up to, really, I think the best thing that scientists could do if they're really interested is meditate and get enlightened, and that'd be the greatest benefit to science. And the rest of it. And that's the point. It's not because the Buddhist teachings are really prove that you can prove them yourself through meditation. They're not like teachings of you can. They're not like using instruments or working in a lab or something. It's something that because you're looking at the mind. You know, it's coming from this awareness of the. Say conditioning of the mind, the impermanence of thoughts and emotions, and the
and the realization of the deathless. So I mean, that's something that you can only do yourself, and you can't prove it to anyone. There's no kind of way you can prove it, except by your own insight and your own living example. So if you, but I think, you know, like modern science has, the criticism that Buddhists have with modern science is that it tends to be so limited. It's based on just, say, objects of the senses. So you're just looking at life, and now, like with quantum physics and modern discoveries, they're realizing that the subject and the object, you can't really separate. You know, you're not just the world isn't just an object to them, but the subject, the mood, the condition of the mind affects how you perceive the objects. So I mean, if you're just a conditioned creature, and we tend to, like, modern science is based on kind of empirical investigation and rational and on the rational and logical investigation of things. So it sees things in a very kind of logical way, and oftentimes when you're imposing logic onto an experience, you miss it. You can't, because life as a direct experience isn't logical, is it? Like intuitive, intuition is your ability to feel life in the present, which isn't, you can't rationalize it, you can only recognize it. Where we tend to see what we're conditioned to see. So if you're a scientist who's looking for a certain thing, then you tend to find it in whatever you're looking at, because you're already primed to perceive it. That's why with like God, for Christians, why they have so much trouble with that is because they're already primed to conceive God as a certain thing, and then they're looking for God as some kind of father figure, whatever. It's a they don't see what they're doing. They're merely conditioned to have a perception, and then their meditations are around trying to see this, to see this God in the way they perceive. And of course, some can actually do that. You start creating it, you know, through concentrating the mind. Eventually, what you believe in will appear, but. In the way of proper meditation, right meditation, then we're letting go of all preconceptions. It's just emptying the mind like the tabula rasa, completely blank, completely pure. Nothing. You know, there's no conditioning in it. We can realize that, know that when the mind is empty. Then we've got the perspective on the conditions that arise, you know, even all the kind of emotional habits and biases and preconceptions and assumptions that we have that are conditioned into us from early childhood. We begin to get them, we begin to see them as mental objects rather than interpret life from those subtle objects.
Point I'm making is personally, the process that are required to attain higher states in Buddhism, doing all the latest technology like the computers and the modern age, etc. To develop an insight into and plot the development that goes through a human being when at each state he attains whatever, and then one could perhaps analyze what the age of the past and what it does, etc. Perhaps conduct research in that way rather than in another way. And what I'm saying is if you do have that kind of practice and that kind of research done on a very timely basis, I think that would give more credibility to the world at large, who are more tuned to this and more respect the scientific method than any other method. And that would perhaps get people to look into what Buddhism can offer on a scientific basis and compare and contrast with other regions we do not, just depend on faith and nothing else.
Well, I think that's happening. I think like there's more in the scientific world that you find a lot more things coming together, getting more Buddhist-like. And but I'm also I think that science has been too exalted in the West. I don't think it's as good as it says it is, and so I think the rational mind and the ability has been elevated and given a kind of more importance than it really has, because you find in other religions a more kind of mythological symbolism has a tremendous power, emotional power has to be taken into account. So I mean, you're finding the kind of now how I'm in picking up the time is that there's a coming together of everything, really, like a real university, where even the things like shamanism or primitive religions and not to mention kind of traditional religions and the whole religious experience and rational gifts of humanity are—it's instead of holding one up and putting the other down, there's a coming together, an understanding of the psychophysical processes, and not exalting one thing over another, but a much more kind of profound understanding of life in all its aspects, from the psychic levels to the rational ones, to the objects of the mind, to the emotional experiences, and that in which we're finding through that, then we're much more compassionate and understanding, where I mean we can be really arrogant in being brought up in a kind of Western way with modern education, and really I was brought up to be quite arrogant, thinking we're so much better off than say those people that believe in gods in the trees, animistic people, and a kind of way of looking down on somebody else, and a kind of exaltation of your own cultural conditioning, which to me, when you look at it, is pretty unpleasant for yourself. To be arrogant and to think yourself better than somebody else is a form of suffering, if you really look at it. When I start thinking I'm better than somebody else, if I really look at that feeling, it's not a pleasant mental state. It's not liberating. Yes?
For me, I find the science very confusing and makes me very anxious.
Well, it's, I mean, you have different Buddhist interpretations. So, I mean, in Mahayana Buddhism, you have much more emphasis on, like, the compassionate side. And so they talk about saving all sentient beings, the Bodhisattva, and that can be seen in terms of just a kind of literal interpretation, or one can use that in pointing to a realization of that there aren't any that the sentient side is just the appearance, and that there's basically, and there's the natural state is enlightenment. And it's not attained by anybody, but it's realized. It can be realized by any of us at any moment. And so, I mean, but then these are just ways of using the limitation of language to try to describe something beyond language or perception. So, you know, the conditioning of the mind is to see yourself as one person. Because of the being in a physical form, and then to you have a name, you have a history, you have a personality, and so forth. You have a past, and you have a future, and you see yourself as separate from everyone else. You know, as a I'm separate from you, and these are the assumptions we make from just say that. The ignorant conditioning of the mind, just on the conventional level of how everyday people see the world. We see the world in terms of, you know, it's flat, it's that I'm separate from you, and we have a whole kind of conditioned attitude built around that, the appearance of that. But then as you, you know, just like the in terms of the flat world theory, that's how the world appears to the eye. I don't see a globe out there, I see flat land. And if I want to go to London, I don't get a globe to go, I get a flat map. And so on the level of just practicality, I mean, the conventional world is oftentimes it's all right, and even though it's not the ultimate reality, it's adequate enough for us to survive and live and go from one place to another and communicate. But then as we develop intuitive awareness, then we're getting beyond just the appearances and the conventions of that we're used to, and to seeing the reality beyond them, such as when I'm mindful,
and not attached and lost in my own thoughts or emotions, and then you're mindful, and that mindfulness is the same. It's not two. It's not my mindfulness and as if it's in my head. It's just I've let go of the separating things. And then we relate, then on the level of convention we might say, I'm here and you're there, in terms of convention, but in terms of what really is, there's oneness, that purity, that pure intelligence, that pure state isn't anybody's, isn't any person's, but we can all tune into it. And then, so then we realize the power there is in just mindfulness, because when we trust in that, it's more like an act of, because we can't get it in terms of, you know, we can't show it as a thing or prove it. We can only realize it. Then, as we realize that, then there's a sense of being one with everything, of being, you know, you're no longer going on with the attitudes of separation as being the reality. And then you realize that in that state of awareness, then you send, like you pray, or you send forth metta or compassion. And then that has its powerful effect on all sentient beings. It's not like it's just a nice kind of sentimental thought in the head, in my head. And it's through the power of these prayers and this awareness that the world isn't worse than it is. Because it could be worse than it is now. Isn't it? Well, we've got to try to influence it. Well, what we mean by acceptance doesn't. It's like you can't really understand or change anything or help anyone until you accept the way it is. Like, if you really want to help somebody, you have to accept them the way they are. It doesn't mean that you like everything about them. It doesn't mean that you're going to like and approve, in order to understand somebody, you have to accept them. If we don't accept people, then we never understand them. We tend to just react just react to them. So it's like to really know something, you have to accept it in all its good and bad aspects, and then. In that acceptance, then we can see skillful ways of helping, of influencing, of just being patient and waiting, so that we're not coming from a hidden agenda or a bias. We can always, if I think I know what you need, say I form an opinion about you. And then whenever I see you, I've already decided what you are, and so I just react. I project my own views onto you, and then you feel it. You feel that you're being looked down on, and then you tend to react. Unless you're developing mindfulness and wisdom, then you just react to my reactions. But when But when we don't do that, then when I accept you for at this moment, just the way you are, then there's an openness and a sensitivity. And even, say, somebody that has been abusive to me in the present, if I can accept that the way it is in the present, then I find I have a way of resolving that the problems that bring that abuse. And I've seen this work very well in a community life, where if somebody starts abusing me and then I get offended and get on my high horse and that, then that just exacerbates the problem and increases the division. But as I learn how to be more patient and accepting, then even the abusive side of somebody is not being triggered, it's not being reinforced, and that gives a chance to understand what the real problem is. Yeah, it's not acceptance isn't. I mean, it's a word that doesn't mean a kind of a fatal resignation. It's much more of an interest in the situation. It's not like somebody just, I'll just take it and I'm kind of in a wimpy way. But it's acceptance, much more like taking a real interest and paying attention to the situation, rather than reacting, reacting if somebody starts abusing me, you can't talk to me like that, it would be one reaction. And then the other extreme one, well, I must be compassionate and not get angry. is the other, trying to be, one who's accepting. But that's not accepting. That's merely kind of, you're not accepting what you're feeling. You have to, in acceptance, you're accepting both. You're taking an interest in what the other person's doing to you. I mean, remember one time a man getting really angry with me, and he was really being abusive to me verbally, and I took a real interest in it. I mean, I just listened, and I felt it. I watched how the kind of aggressive gestures he was making towards me, and the words he was using, how they affected me, my body, and I was watching my own emotional reaction, wanting to set him straight, wanting to tell him off, wanting to tell him to get out, and my emotional reactions would be like that, but I didn't follow those reactions, but I felt them. And because I took an interest in both, in the situation, then what happened was he finally saw what he was doing, and he stopped. And we could talk about what the real problem was. He couldn't put me on the defensive. And I gave him a chance to have a go at me when I'm in a superior position of being the head of the monastery. I could pull rank and you have a certain amount of power to to get out of those situations if I wanted to. But and so he was just making sure, don't you get up and go, that kind of thing. So I just accepted, but it wasn't out of cowardice or fear, but more out of this taking an interest in it. And then, once he kind of got it out, then he became receptive. And we could say, well, what is really the problem here? And we can talk about it. Or if the other, if I would have resented, if I was just being wimpy and just, I'd hate myself and I'd hate him. It's the result when you hate yourself because you're just being weak and wishy-washy and cowardly. And then if I stood up to him and shouted out down at him, I'd hate myself because I knew that I'm just reacting and just trying to overpower him out of fear and just to prove that I'm, you know, a kind of male power trip. And so I... but this other way was quite interesting, you know, and gave me a sense of a kind of insight into how to deal better with difficult emotional scenes than I'd ever been able to do before. Well, you just accept that too. Right, I mean, because something in you hates to have them feel they won. I find it really, it's a challenge because you have to go against your conceit a lot, you know, because it's when one has a lot of, you know, conceit to deal with, you know, of not wanting to, feeling I'm not going to take this from anybody or you know, not wanting to be seen as weak or disempowered by somebody, things like this. So it, you know, you can see yourself kind of feeling, you know, these kind of emotions come up during those kind of situations. But that's where mindfulness is the. Once you begin to see how it works, and what your conditioning is, then the result of it is good because if you're really doing it properly, you do feel a sense of self-respect and a sense of having let go of things and a sense of inner peace that comes as a result of that kind of response.
Quite back to the social life, sometimes. Because I've noticed that in social gatherings, the great deal of what people do and what I would do if I let myself do it is to pontificate. And if you choose not to pontificate, because you are trying to be mindful of recognizing the fact that you don't.
Yes, I'm gotten to be a real bore now. I'd be a real flop at a cocktail party. Disaster. Well, prayer is a word. I mean, it's a Christian word. So, but see how I relate to that word is, like Christian mysticism, the ultimate prayer is silence, and that's very much what Buddhists like. There's a beseeching kind of prayer where you're like a child's prayer, where you're asking God to do things for you. And then, and then there's metta in Buddhism, where you're this sense of radiating kindness and goodwill, because we live in a radiant universe. So radiation is one of our gifts. So we can radiate, and so like this radiating of metta, or sending forth this goodwill, is like a prayer. Sending goodwill to all beings, and then the silence is the ultimate, because then it's no longer it's getting beyond the radiance to the pure unconditioned, where the healing can be most effective. But it seems like nothing, actually. That's where in most people see it as not worth anything, or it's like you're not doing anything, because it seems like nothing to the emotional, conditioned emotions. And that's where you know this reflectiveness in Buddhism is so helpful, so you begin to see, you know, how you begin to realize how powerful it is, even though emotionally it still seems like nothing. And that's why it's like an act of faith. Or I notice, like in Buddhism, the saddha, or the faith, or the confidence is increases as you practice, and that faith is more like a real trust in just being attentive and aware and empty, rather than thinking. Because usually like Western people are often, like, one of our big problems is obsessive desires to do things. We can feel so guilty if we aren't busy. We're a kind of society that has work oriented and an idea of attaining, and therefore it's, and I just from my own experience just see how, you know, not doing something, even meditation can be, we've got to meditate, you know, the sense of got to meditate is being something you do. And then because if you never penetrate that illusion of compulsive doing, then you're always feeling you're never meditating enough, or you should meditate more, or you should sit longer, or you should take more retreats and so forth, and you're always feeling guilty about the fact that you're not as good, you're not meditating as much as you think you should meditate, and it goes on and on like that. So in reflective meditation, you're getting even behind that sense of I've got to do something, and letting go of that, then more and more you realize that just the restfulness in the peace and the natural purity of being. But at first, it's hard to accept emotionally, because emotionally we resist it. It's because it seems like nothing.
Is that then nothingness, and that the purity of being, is that what you're trying to say in relation to the people? We take that purity of being and we give it to ourselves, and we try to learn to accept and not accept.
Yeah, it's beyond description, but it is an act of trust, because it may be your cynical mind might think, oh, it's all, you know, if I send metta to the Bosnians, I mean, what good is it going to do? You know, that's a negative reaction. But what else is there to do? You know, could eat chocolate, watch television, watch one of these shows where everybody's telling about all their problems? Or we could send metta to the Bosnians. Or we could meditate in silence. Because in Bosnians and all that, when you're getting to the common ground of being in the silence, where there's no Bosnians, no English or whatever, it's you're getting outside the, you know, beyond the conditioning. I have great faith in that, that the emptiness of the mind is very powerful. And that's why, you know, they have, you know, like in Thailand, for example, the Thais have great faith in their ajahns, their teachers, monks. Some of the monks who they feel are very highly attained, and I used to scoff at that. I used to, you know, the Western cynic when I lived in Thailand. But then more and more, I think maybe they got a point. That Thailand is often, I've been pretty lucky compared to most countries, avoiding all kinds of unpleasantness, and because they do have some very powerful empty minds in Thailand, you know. So the monks who are very, you know, are very pure. And then you think about they used to talk about arahants living in caves in the Himalayas. I used to scoff at that. I think, well, that's just make-believe. And I think, probably there are, you know. And that's why the world isn't worse than it is. And here in Britain, there are probably all kinds of enlightened beings that you never guess. You never imagine that this person or that. How do we know? You know, and Britain must have something very good protecting it, because it's another very fortunate place to live. So, I mean, you know, it's, I mean, this is just, you know, I'm just thinking out loud. Knowing the capacity for evil in humanity, you wonder why it isn't worse. Because, I mean, basically, we love the good. You know, most of us love the good, yes? Yeah, yeah. No, not a blank, non-attached to things. Free mind. It's not empty. Doesn't mean in terms of our experience. For example, you know, you recognize the conditions that are affecting you. There's this body and consciousness, and it feels, and therefore, you know, this is for the lifetime of this body. It's got, you know, whatever impinges on it's going to pick up. It's just the way things are. So if something goes in front of your vision, then you feel it. It's attractive, then you feel attracted. If it's repulsive, you feel repelled. The empty mind then is. It doesn't mean that this process isn't working anymore, that we don't feel anything, but it means we're not attached to any of the feelings. We're aware of them as a flux and a flow through consciousness, rather than just being, you know. If we're not aware, then we tend to react. If it's attractive, I like that. If it's ugly, we say, get rid of it. And so we're always. We're always going up and down with the conditions affecting us. So somebody, you know, the worldly dhammas. Somebody says you're wonderful, and you say I'm happy. And then somebody says you're a horrible person. I'm depressed. So you're always a victim, you know, of whether it's rainy or sunny, or whether somebody likes you or doesn't, or whether you're rich or poor, or healthy or sickly. And then your mind is reacting all the time. It's going up and down like a yo-yo. But in empty mind, then there's awareness of what's happening, but you're not following it. You're not becoming those things. So we call that emptiness. Right, consciousness and the ego, of course, is a conditioned thing out of ignorance. I mean, that's why, you know, when we're operating from the ego, then we're always, you know, we're happy with good fortune, then we're depressed with bad fortune. The ego's that way. But there's something behind your ego that is wise and knows. The ego you can detect as an object. When you're aware, you can see what your ego is. It's an object rather than the subject. But when you grasp your ego, then you become the ego. And then you interpret everything from, I like this and I don't like that. But when there's that mindfulness, then it's like there's a transcendent awareness. And so then the ego you can see. When your ego says, I like this and I don't like that, you're aware of that. That's for what it is. And you're not judging it, you're not making any value judgments against it, you're just recognizing it, you're no longer being taken over by it. So I think it's time to call it a day. Come back next Sunday, same time, same place.